The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Welcome to Raising Good Humans. I'm Dr. Aliza Pressman, and today I'm thrilled to be in conversation with Ellen Galinsky. This is not her first time here. She is a beautiful colleague and friend, and her latest book, The Breakthrough Years, A New Scientific Framework for Raising Thriving Teens, is today's topic. And I'm just going to tell you what I said in my blurb because I loved this book so much and I'm excited for all of you to have access to it. I said, so often the narrative about adolescence tells us our children are in trouble. This meticulously researched book is different. It highlights the timing of heightened adolescent brain plasticity, thus giving us an opportunity to support adolescents and the tools to navigate these changes. If you have, care for, or care about an adolescent, this book will change your relationship and, most importantly, inspire you, not frighten you in the process. So today's specific conversation is around thinking about three pain points that are so salient in the news right now and so on the top of minds of anyone raising emerging adolescents and adolescents. One is balancing the pressure to achieve with helping kids with motivation at a time when motivation is lower than ever, when post-pandemic school interest is low, and what's going on, because both of those things feel very misaligned. We're also talking about the mental health crisis in our youth and what that means for parents and what we can do. And finally, we're talking about social media because, it's a big topic right now, and people have so many questions, and there are just so many different ways to look at this topic. And so I am bringing in different experts coming at it from different approaches. What I will tell you is that Ellen is meticulous, as I said in the blurb, about her research and other people's research, and bringing in robust and important researchers into the conversation. So she is a trusted source. One of the things we go over is her shared solutions framework, which is so effective with dealing with conflicts with adolescents. And we're talking a lot about executive function skills and promoting those skills to help kids succeed now and in the future. I'm so thrilled to have her here. This won't be our last conversation about this topic. And if you enjoy this episode, please write a little review on Apple Podcasts, not just because it makes me feel warm and fuzzy, but really it helps get the word out. When Apple sees reviews, they get very excited about it and they give more eyeballs to the podcast. So it helps the podcast grow. And of course, giving a 5-star rating if you're in a rush and you do not have time for a review. If you have anything less appealing to say, but constructive criticism is always welcome, I encourage you to DM me on @RaisingGoodHumansPodcast. Also, on the topic of reviews, if you can go to Amazon, if you're just in this I want to do something nice mood, go to Amazon and write a review of my book, The 5 Principles of Parenting, because that also is really, really helpful and important at getting the word out. Who knew? I did not. And don't forget, I do have a free newsletter, dralizapressman.substack.com. And there is a paid version for $4.99 a month, which includes the same articles. There's just an added monthly live Zoom group where we just talk about whatever is going on in your parenting in that particular moment. It's just a parent group, frankly, typically pretty small and intimate and just a nice opportunity to connect. This is a little 5-minute segment that is separate from the episode. I want to tell you that I was on a panel at Snapchat last week. We are going to be talking about social media and technology on this episode. So this is a perfect time to just go into what was said on this panel, just some of the key takeaways. I think tech companies right now know that they need to make a lot of changes and shift all the protections and all of the ways that we're using the technology and supporting our kids. This was a conversation with myself, with Dr. Tracy Baxley. She's at Social Justice Parenting, and Lars, the founder of Half a Story, which her name is actually Larissa May, and she really struggled with mental health on social media. So she's been leading kind of a digital well-being movement for young people. The panel also includes Rachel Hockhauser, Snapchat's head of safety operations outreach. And here are some of the takeaways that I think are just super concrete, and we get more into this in the episode. But one of the things that was clear is that we can't be so judgmental sounding when we talk to our kids about social media and technology use and not sort of engage with them in a way that makes them feel like it's the rock and roll or whatever rebellion that they're going to have of that generation, and that we are actually curious about it. And also we recognize that it's something that they need to learn over time with skills, with agreements, with, we all agreed contracts are really important. I know you guys, if you have my book, The Five Principles of Parenting, there is a social media and technology contract. It's not in the language that might resonate with your family, so you can just use it as a guide. We also talked a lot about using the safety tools that tech does currently provide that we might not know about, which I know is a huge ask, because ideally we would have a system across the board that makes it so that we don't even need these safety tools. But until policy changes, unfortunately, we have to. So Snapchat has parental tools that allow parents to see which friends are talking to them, which teens they're talking to confidentially report concerns and set content controls. These are things that they're working on to make teens more safe. And also, you should do that with every tech app that your child, and I hope it's not your child, I hope it's your teenager, is using, because we still need to give them support. They definitely do not have the keys to the kingdom and then they just go off and running. We've learned that it's really hard. And I actually don't think that it's just looking at our kids' skills for when they're ready to use these apps. I actually think we also have to think about our time capacity. Like, what do we have time to monitor? So how can we be monitoring and mentoring, not surveilling, but monitoring and mentoring? If we don't have bandwidth, we need to tell our kids that. Like, this isn't just about you having the skills and being ready for this. This is also about me being able to support you. In the same way that we would support our kids with anything that can be both wonderful or dangerous, as long as we have the bandwidth, we can allow that space. And also letting them know that this can change, that if it's not being used appropriately, or if they are suffering, or if it, you know, the rules were broken, that we remove it. One thing that Dr. Baxley mentioned that I thought was an interesting idea was at the top of your teenager's account saying that this account is monitored by a parent, or this account is run by a parent, or this account is overseen by an adult. Now, it's interesting, when I heard her say that, I was like, oh, I can't imagine how much pushback you'd get from that. And yet, I have always told everyone to tell everybody, you know, listen, my parents are looking at this, so whatever you're writing, just know that. So this is just taking it a step further. I thought it was a great idea. I'm not entirely sure how that plays out in the real world, but I think give it a try, particularly if you're new to this and you've just given your kid an account. So it's not like you're going to say, going forward, even though you're 16 and you've had this account, I'd like you to add this. I think that's a harder thing to do and maybe not the primary thing you want to focus on, but I thought it was a really good tip.
The easiest way to reduce time spent on social media and technology in general is to have areas of the household where it's just off limits. For example, the bedroom, or at least the bedroom after a certain hour, because no one needs their phones at night, no matter how much they say they do, and meal times, which are a real source of connection. So thinking about that can help reduce time spent without even having to have an argument about it.
More to come. I have a lot of conversations about this coming up over the next few months. Today's, we touch on it, among other things. We're going to spend a lot of time from different perspectives so that I can give you the best information I can in an area that we all need help with.
Right now, what's popular, which I think aligns very much politically with what's popular to do, is these extreme views on everything. So you can't like just think about the issue and really clearly unpack it because everybody has the agenda of convincing you of a feeling of one way or the other. So I know that you don't do that. And that's why I thought you would be the perfect person to have these conversations with.
I'm so grateful to you for doing this because it is tying parents up in knots. And parents actually want to know the reality.
Yeah.
I know that bad news sells, and it does. So anyone who wants to get their word out there has to be as house on fire polemic as possible. But that isn't what the research says often. And it's destructive. I mean, it's not helping families. It's making them, you know, take social media. It's making them see it as just the incarnate evil. And then they slam down on their kids. Or they ignore it, and slam down on their kids. And it's just not doing any good. So thank you for addressing them.
Okay, so which one should we start with?
You started with mental health, so mental we
health.
Could start with that.
Yeah, okay. So massive increase in the last report, 47% of adolescents feeling persistent hopelessness, sadness, et cetera. That's scary. And it's a huge increase in the last decade. So what's going on? What do you make of this? And how can we really look at the difference between also, I mean, not for nothing, I think that when we take a poll matters as well, like when we're capturing the information and when we're getting that data. These data are from just after
2021. They're from 2021. Like,
just for parents to put that in perspective, what was going on in 2021?
Well, the CDC asks one question, which is, have you been feeling hopelessness, or I don't have the exact words, but not able to persist in your daily activities for at least 2 weeks over the last year? And the numbers went from 21% to 42%. Between 2011 and 2021. So there has been a consistent increase in the people. It's a yes, no question in the young people. These are high schoolers saying yes. And the media was very quick to link that to social media because there's a concurrence, you know, there are parallel paths with social media being released at the same time. I personally think that it is more complex than that. I mean, we'll talk about social media in a moment, but I think there are a number of things going on. You are absolutely right. This question was asked during the pandemic. So even though it has been going up, you would expect that to have some impact. I think that there are more things going on, though. It has been going on for a while than just social media. One, I think, is that young people are more comfortable answering that question as a yes. It's more okay to talk about feelings of anxiety, feelings of depression than it has been before. These are self-reported findings. That doesn't mean we shouldn't take it seriously, but there's just an increased comfort in saying yes. Two, I think that the forces of society are making it really hard to be a teenager these days, really hard to be growing up in these days. I heard that from, you know, I actually go out and ask the kids. I don't make any assumptions. I really ask them what's going on, as well as look at the research. And the things that make it hard are, first, the ability to communicate about what you're feeling. And you wonderfully talked about that when I went to some of your speeches when your book came out. I mean, you were talking about, I remember the wonderful story you told about when you told your mother that some boy, I forget his name, but you said his name. It was kind of wonderful that you said his name, because we all remember that high school boyfriend or junior high school boyfriend. Yeah, totally. I just love that story. And she cried. And I think parents don't know how to deal with adolescents, what sometimes gets called as big feelings. And they are big feelings because in adolescence, we are biologically primed to have stronger feelings than at other times in our lives. It's developmentally necessary because we're going out into the world for the first time. We're, you know, more, we've been going out into the world, but we're going out into the world more on our own for the first time. We know that we're about to leave home at some point in the near future. And we are primed to be more sensitive to what's going on. Is this dangerous? Do I belong here? Am I safe? Do these kids really like me? Am I going to be rejected? Do I fit in? Do I belong? All of those things are absolutely part of beginning to make your way. And it happens in every culture and every species. So we are primed to have these feelings. And yet we just finished taping some young people. They happen to be in Hagerstown, Maryland, talking about what it's like to be a kid these days. And they all say their parents don't know how to talk to them about their feelings. They say, oh, well, I felt that when I was young. And they're thinking, no, actually, you didn't. You know, it's a different world. Or they're saying, you'll get over it. You know, that boyfriend, you know, you won't remember that boyfriend in 5 years. It's no big deal, which in a sense makes them feel alone and that they don't have that pain, you know, that the pain isn't taken seriously. It's disrespectful is what kids are saying. It's like when someone dies. You know, when I hear kids talk about this, I feel like how we talk to people sometimes when there's a death, an immediate death, and we say, yeah, well, you'll get over it, or time will heal, or all those things we say. And we mean well.
Right, right, right.
We absolutely mean well. But I think, you know, there's a middle ground between crying like your mother did, you know, or like, and lots of mothers do, or fathers do, you know, oh, this is the end of the world. I really like that boy. You know, the boy was good for my daughter or son or whoever. And accepting the big feelings without being dismissive. And we're very dismissive. We say things like, oh, you're just a hormonal mess, or you'll get over it. Or kids listed. I asked for one wish that would improve life these days. So I think first it's how we talk to kids with understanding that they feel a certain way. You do feel this way. You're supposed to feel this way. Just even saying that, helping them know that in every country around the world, teenagers are supposed to feel more emotional about things that go on. It just, you know, it's a survival path. So I think that helping us as adults talk to kids would make a difference. I think that's one thing that's going on. The second thing I think is going on is social media. And I think it's not just social media and the fact that we're comparing ourselves to other, and I know we'll talk about this more in a minute, that we're comparing ourselves to other kids and they look perfect and they were invited to the party that we weren't invited to and they've all gone to the mall, like Taylor Swift says, and they didn't invite us and all that stuff, you know, which is so real and so painful. But it's also us as adults, our conflicted feelings about that. And so we say, it's the end of the world. It's just horrible. Executives at social media companies don't let their kids use them. You know, you're dooming yourself by using them. And then we don't, you know, and then we go back to being on social media ourselves. We're just very confused about how to handle them. I'll save that conversation for a moment. A third thing that I think is going on with a mental health crisis is parents fixing things for kids. It's the time in our lives when we need to have autonomy, some autonomy. Our brains as adolescents light up, whoa, big time, when we have some say over our lives. It's important to be treated with respect. It's like a psychological need. I think of it as a psychological need. It's that important to have some autonomy. And that fits into theories and research for the last 30, 40 years. This is not an original idea of mine. But it's really important to say that. And we are not helping kids learn the skills that they need to tackle these issues by themselves. So I think some of the kids falling apart in college and the levels of anxiety in college are the lack of our helping them using autonomy supportive ways to manage their behavior.
And now a quick word from my sponsors. Do you know how much cash back you're leaving on the table?
when you use the wrong credit card? Imagine earning up to 5% cash back on your groceries for the next 30 years and how much cash that is. So NerdWallet helps everyone make smarter financial decisions today that future you will thank you for. And with NerdWallet, you're not going to regret on missing out on rewards because NerdWallet lets you compare smart cashback credit cards side by side to make the most of your everyday spending. Okay, so just think about what you could do with all that cashback. Set it aside and just imagine yourself having a spa day or a great getaway with kids or without kids. Sorry, kids. Whatever it is, make it happen with a smarter cashback credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit card savings accounts and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. And of course, as with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms do apply. KiwiCo delivers serious fun learning for kids of all ages through hands-on projects and activities. Here's my favorite thing about KiwiCo. I know that when you have kids, particularly younger kids, sometimes you just need a break. And when you want that break, it is so reasonable and so natural to just turn on the screens because you don't want to think. You just want a break. But KiwiCo puts everything you could possibly need in a really fun and engaging hands-on project into a box, sends it to you. And so instead of feeling like, I can't take it anymore, I'm turning on the screens, you've got this incredible activity designed to introduce your kids to exciting science, technology, and art. There's always something new, and it's like plug and play. You don't have to do a thing. And they have 9 monthly programs to choose from. So it's there for kids of all ages. I try a lot of the projects because, first of all, I'm a kid at heart. And second of all, I have to make sure that what I'm telling you about is actually cool and legit. So one of the ones I do the most is, in no great surprise, the science of ice cream. Because by the way, you can get kids of any age to do that one. Redefine learning with play. Explore projects that build confidence and problem-solving skills with KiwiCo. Get 50% off your first month on any of their great lines at KiwiCo.com with the promo code RGH. That's 50% off your first month at KIWICO.com, promo code RGH.
Another thing that I think is going on is parents' work stress. I mean, nobody talks about this, but my research has shown for years that when parents are stressed, kids are stressed. And, you know, I did a study 20 years ago and I replicated the findings in this study where I asked kids if they had one wish to improve the way their mother's or father's job affects their lives. And they said they wished that the largest proportion of kids didn't wish for more time. They wish their parents were less tired and less stressed. So I think that we can't negate the fact of the environment. And then there's the other issue that you raise, which is the pressure to achieve, where kids feel very much like a product almost, you know. They're pleasing their parents by the A that they got. And so I think that they're just a whole, you know, and then biologically, it's a time when mental health issues surface so that things can begin to spiral for good or, you know, for better or for worse. And so mental health issues do surface during the teenage years, a large proportion of them. So I think that that sort of the propensity for that to happen genetically in our development, when the hormones of puberty do reset things, in addition to a lot of the societal factors. And then we have a mental health system that is, you know, the stories that parents told me about trying to find help for their kids.
I know. You know, it's so sad because there's like a big book going out now. A journalist is talking about how bad therapy is harming kids. I'm like, they can't even get a therapist. Good luck.
Yeah, exactly.
There is no, for the kids for whom it's urgent, it's so hard to get care. I mean, you remember that time there was like, that guy who stood up, we were at some Aspen Institute thing, and he stood up and just straight up said, like, I went to your hospital. I could not get, there was like a 1-year waiting list to even get a service. So yeah. I think it's so interesting that we don't talk about the fact that we don't have any way of managing this mental health crisis with the very people everyone is saying in the you know, in pop culture conversations, is that the right word? The like failings of therapy or treatment or medication, you can't even get in for an appointment. So I actually don't know why anybody's choosing that to take on. We need to fix the system to have access.
We do. We do. I mean, I've been consulting with the federal government, and it's just every day something that we talk about. And then you want therapists beyond just physically finding one. You want someone who understands the background, the culture, the race, the ethnicity of the person who they're treating. And you know, good luck there too. You just don't have that. And then if kids need medication, it's like a chemistry experiment, as one parent told me. You know, you're having to figure out what works. I mean, ultimately, as a persistent parent, you can figure it out, just like we figured out childcare, just like we figured out, you know, all the things that society makes so, so, so hard for us. But it's a real challenge to find the right help. One of the more promising things, I think, is the notion that kids tend to recover best when their helper's not being helped. And there's really strong research on the importance of being a helper. And the stories that the people I interviewed who were facing really severe mental health problems, suicidal, you know, drugs, partying, all those sorts of things, ended up becoming helpers. I mean, they didn't become helpers right away, but once they were over the crisis of their, you know, the worst part of their mental health challenges, they then joined a club in their school that could help other kids. So I think there are things that we can do as a stopgap. I also think that I've been working with John Hopkins, and art as a form of self-expression is, again, not going to make up for the crazy therapeutic system that we have in this country, or lack thereof. But again, the kids I interviewed often turn to ways of self-expression to help them heal, like painting, like dance, like, and they don't have to be good at it. It could be singing in the shower. Yeah, but it's, I think art is another avenue of a way of trying to deal with this. And then I look very closely, Aliza, at what worked when I was talking to people who were parents who were going through the mental health crisis, and found real help in the work of James Gross and Angela Duckworth and others who look at the different strategies we use for self-control. And self-control means that we're aligning our future self with our present self. We're achieving a goal we want to achieve. And things like changing the situation. So moving schools or getting the right therapist, situation selection, it's called. And if we can't do that, then situation modification. If your child is in school with a bunch of kids who are making them feel horrible, helping them to find other friends. So you try to modify the situation. And then changing how we think about it. I know one parent talked about moving from seeing, this would be, you know, a cognitive change strategy. But one parent talked about moving from seeing her child like having a heart attack and she needed to fix it. So she was doing that thing that I don't think helps kids learn the skills that they need for parenthood. You called me the OG of executive function. So here I am.
No, I wanted you to dig into executive function for that reason. So here we are.
Here we are. And I think helping kids learn to take on challenges is really critical rather than fixing it for kids. And this parent particularly was beautifully articulate where she talked about how she changed from seeing her child's illness as like a heart attack that she had to get her to the hospital and fix it right away, to validating her and helping her learn to solve her problems herself. Finding people who could help her see it differently, finding the therapies that could help her reframe it, and even helping her, you know, get less triggered by things like that. One therapy was going into a school that where she didn't belong, and then asking strangers questions that would help her like not freak out so much by other kids. So I think there are a lot of promising things that we as parents can do too.
And now a break so I can tell you about my sponsors. I love skincare routines, as you know, and I love saving time, as you know, because I just feel like we just have no time. And any extra minutes that you can get from simplifying your skincare routine means A, that you're more likely to do it, and B, that you can do things that matter more to you. Because there's so much out there, I love a product that has a system, and Dime Beauty has the Works system. So Dime Beauty is a clean, high-end skincare line that's actually affordable and works because Dime didn't sacrifice performance to make it clean. Clean meaning Dime is 100% transparent about every single ingredient, so you can use their products with confidence. And also, the Works system has everything you need in one powerful package. So it includes a gentle cleanser, a toner, two incredible serums, two luxurious moisturizers. I'm 50. I need to take care of my skin. That's just the way it is. I love these products, and you know, you need to commit to routines also just for moments in your day that are predictable to keep you feeling calm. Dime has over 2 million happy customers, so you can check out their product reviews if you don't want to just go by the ad. They're all 5 stars. And so, you know, love your skin again. Go to dimebeautyco.com and unlock your discount on the site. That's dimebeautyco.com, dimebeautyco.com. IQBar has great plant-based protein bars that are so quick. A little brain boost, a little snack. You can rehydrate with their IQ mix first thing in the morning or after a workout. And they even have an IQ Joe to sustain your energy and focus all day long. When I am hungry, I am a hangry person. Like, it comes on me and then I must feed it for everybody's sake. So I actually have to have a snack in my console in my car because I live in Los Angeles. There's so much traffic. And I inevitably realize, oh my God, I'm doing pickup. It's exactly when I'm so hungry. I do not want to be in bad mood. Oh, here's my IQ bar. So I'm going to just say, get an IQ bar. They have really good flavors. You can get the ultimate sampler pack to figure out what you want and what your favorite products are. Maybe it's peanut butter chip. Maybe it's chocolate sea salt. Maybe it's wild blueberry. Mine is chocolate sea salt. And IQ Bar makes the number one brain and body nutrition bar, hydration mix, and instant coffee in the U.S. Refuel smarter with IQ Bar's ultimate sampler pack. That's 7 IQ bars, 4 IQ mix sticks, and 4 IQ Joe sticks. And now our special podcast listeners get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus get free shipping. So to get your 20% off, all you do is just text HUMANS to 64,000. Get your discount by texting HUMANS to 64,000. That's HUMANS to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply, so see terms for details.
I know with self-control, that's a really good example of something that there are strategies for us and there are strategies for the adolescents and kids in our lives. Can you expand on some of that a little bit more?
Well, executive function skills are the skills, I mean, I feel like it's the biggest secret in our society. It's like
no matter how much it should be the first thing we're talking about, it doesn't seem to land. Even though everybody's in research, it's not like this is hidden research. It's not like the people within this field aren't talking about it ad nauseum. It's that nobody listens to it because I think it's a little bit more boring than saying the world is on fire and we have to say, like, cancel everything we've been doing and panicking. So I think let's lean into executive function because this is something we can work on, we can grow, we can actually have an influence on and moves the needle.
Executive function skills have been shown by 20, 30 years of research, and you and I know this very well because we worked with the Mount Sinai Parenting Curriculum, Keystones of Development, where we shared this information. They're the skills that you need that bring together your social, emotional, and your cognitive capacities to reach a goal, to solve a problem, to be intentional. And studies show that they are more important, let's just say, for school readiness than entry-level reading or math. They show that they're more important for school achievement than academic capabilities, IQ, or even your socioeconomic background. They're important for life success. They're predictive of health and well-being when you're in your 30s. It's just the research is really powerful. And So those the skills themselves are brain-based skills. People think of them sometimes as soft skills. They're not soft skills. They're the most neurocognitive skills that we have. They take place in the prefrontal cortex and other regions connected with it. They are working memory, which is using what you know in order to solve a problem, to just do whatever you need to do. They're thinking flexibly, so not seeing things one way, seeing them another way when the situation changes. They're reflecting, so stepping back. That actually doesn't take place in the executive function part of the brain. That's more of the default network. But stepping back and reflecting, that pause, which is so critical. And you talk about that. And it's self-control, which is not going on automatic, but doing what you need to do to achieve your goal. Those are the brain-based skills. And then they're fundamental for setting goals and strategies. They're fundamental for how we understand other people and their thinking or feeling, perspective taking. They're fundamental for how we communicate and how we collaborate. They're fundamental for solving problems, for how we make meaning of situations, how we think creatively, how we put information together, and how we actually arrive at a solution. And they're fundamental for taking on challenges. Those are the five skills that I talk about in the breakthrough years as being so important that are based on that. I'm not just going to wait, though. I'm tired of waiting. We've just got to take this little secret that's in the research and take it out, because I think we could make a difference in the academic problems that kids are facing these days. You talked about both the pressure to achieve, but even so, kids are dropping out of, I know they're dropping out of learning. School engagement is very low. So, you know, I have my own data on that. And so what I'm doing is going to work with the school superintendent organization, AASA, and we're going to develop new tools and new training so that we infuse these into what teachers do in an everyday way. It's not like some little extra thing you do for 15
special
minutes.
Yeah. And actually, I think that's heartening for parents too, because similar to what we do with physicians, these don't require extra time and energy outside of what you're already doing anyway. So I think that's what's beautiful. And you're right. There's no reason to wait and not scream about this all the time while everyone else is sounding alarm bells. I think this is, you know, like what is so important to get into parents' hands. It puts the power back into our hands, and it's really, really doable.
Yeah. And there's simple things like when your child comes to you with a problem. Well, I mean, I have a process in the book that worked really well for me when I was a teacher. I used it as a parent. I did not have the wild and crazy, nutso teenage years with both of my kids that some of my friends were having, because I think I used the strategy, which is taking on challenges strategy. It's called shared solutions. And what it does is help children learn to solve their own problems. So let's say a parent I talked to last week used it with a child who's 12. He was coming in from school. He was scattering all of his stuff all over the place, you know, beeline for the couch and his games. You know, I've been stressed out by school. I need to go play games. Well, you know, that was, she had a peaceful, you know, however long she let him be on games, but that was peaceful, she and her husband. But then it was really hard to get him off. And there was all this stuff all over the house. He wasn't cleaning up. And, you know, ultimately, then the rest of the evening would be a disaster because he was now even more tired. He hadn't done his homework and there was cleanup time and homework to do. So what she did was she had a meeting with her child and shared solutions. You have to agree to respect what your child is doing. You have to, you know, not judge them or criticize them. You have to sort of present it as a problem to be solved. So there's a respectful listening stance that we take as parents or teachers. And then we say, okay, here's the problem. This is not working for me. You know, we just listed the problems.
Yeah.
And then what ideas do you have? The second step is you brainstorm solutions. What ideas do you have to solve this? So you're not fixing it for the child. You're teaching the child, in this case, it was a boy, 12-year-old boy, he can fix the problem. He can solve this. And then you write, you say, I'm going to write down all the ideas, and sort of the crazier the better. No, wacko ideas are really good because they make you laugh, but you can't judge them. And then you go back in the third step and you say, what would work about this idea for me? And what would work about it for you? So you ask your child to be a perspective taker and think about, well, that might work for me, but it's, you know, I'll just get off of it. I'll tell you that I'll just get off of it, but then I won't. You know, that doesn't work for me. We've tried that. I know that doesn't work. And then you pick one to try that has the best chance of working for both your child and you. You know, you agree to one to try. And then you try it out and you consider it a change experiment because it might not work forever. And you go back and do it again. So in this case, this 12-year-old decided that if he walked in a different door to school, he would do it differently. So he literally walks in the door now where the hooks are and the shelves are and the boxes are for putting away his stuff. So he puts away his stuff. He does his chores, so to speak, as he walks into the house. And then he has a choice about whether he does. So they're trying this. It may not work. But he has a choice about whether he does videos, you know, gaming first or homework first, but he will set a timer for 45 minutes. And it was his idea. He's going to set the timer. So if he's said that, his mom told me 3 days later that it was actually working because he set the rule up. And it just, it made her cry because this thing that was just this intractable problem. So what we're doing is we're helping children learn the executive function-based skills. In this case, the skill is taking on challenges to solve a problem that they have, which empowers them not for that immediate situation, but can empower them for the next challenge that they face in life.
And importantly, when you talk about that, we're not talking about what I think gets people confused is that there's something permissive in the conversation because we're having the adolescent is contributing to problem solving. In fact, the problem stated was very clearly like this parent is in charge and is not okay with what's been going on. It's just including your kid in the solution not only makes it more likely, like just for everything to move more smoothly, but also, as you said, you're building all those different executive function skills. I mean, I guess it's like the little tiny muscles in the different ways that you were talking about. Problem solving, perspective taking, those are all getting worked out in that moment. So,
and what's wonderful about that is there's a lot of research on this. So you're exactly right. It is not permissive at all. There's permissive parenting, you know, do whatever you want. There's authoritarian parenting, which is, you know, here are the rules and you'll do them. And there's no discussion because I said so. And there's autonomy supportive parenting. And this is in that middle called autonomy support, where you state the rules. The rules are the parents. You know, you will do your home chores, you will do your homework, and we will have pleasant evenings. We're not going to have an evening that's, everybody's having a fit. And then your child comes up with solutions that would make it work for your child and for you. They have to make it work for both of you. They have to find a solution that's mutually agreeable. And it might take a while if you've never done this with your child, but I know it worked with my kids. I know it worked with when I was teaching. And there's a huge literature, even parents who help their kids with homework, rather than doing the homework for the child. This is research of Wendy Grolnick. It is so different. Or Wendy Grolnick, Clark University, has done research on kids who live in not safe neighborhoods. And having, so you there you think, well, you then have to be really very authoritarian. Uh-huh. But in that case, autonomy support once, you know, you don't set your child out with no knowledge of the situation. So you're a little bit more directive in the beginning, your guardrails. But as your child knows the situation of how to manage the neighborhood, for example, then being autonomy supportive. So autonomy supportive is the opposite of being controlling. It's really helping your child problem solve with you. And it works in offices too. I use it at work. You know, it's a very great way of having everyone on the same team and rowing the boat in the same direction.
And now a quick word from my sponsors. This show is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. Give online therapy a try at betterhelp.com/humans and get on your way to being your best self. Of course, I'm a proponent of therapy. Mental health is a life mission of mine. One of the challenges is actually getting a therapist. finding a therapist that actually can see you when it fits into your schedule, and getting to the therapist. And so online therapy has become more and more popular as we found out that it's actually effective and helpful, and particularly for busy caregivers, this is a great option. Therapy can mean you're going because you just feel like you want to check in, you want to be held accountable to someone, you want to talk through some things, or you want to work on positive coping skills, setting boundaries. There are so many, the list is endless about what's going on. It could also be that you just are feeling like you need a change, or you're struggling to connect. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. They make it so easy. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient. It's designed for flexibility. It's designed to be suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if it's the wrong match, you can switch therapist at any time for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/humans today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/humans. BetterHelp.com/humans. There's no question. This is so rooted in research. It's the really every time anybody talks about anything extreme that's going on, it kind of feels like, okay, well, we already know this is sort of the balanced approach in between. And it's not like it's new. It's so robust, and there's so little clarity out there. If this, we know, is beneficial.
It's also autonomy, supportive teaching, and parenting.
Are also
preludes to executive function skills. They're predictive. The people who discovered this approach to parenting brought kids into labs and they watched them do puzzles, you know, and how the parents interacted with them when they were doing a puzzle that was too hard for the child, or they watched them doing homework, you know, sort of challenging situations for parents, and discovered this third way, you know, this third path called autonomy supportive parenting. And they were looking for what is predictive of these executive function or executive function based skills, because we know they're so successful. So what are parents doing that promote them? That's how this whole field of research came into being.
And again, it's just what's wonderful. I think there's this meta thing of that's also the direction that the support for parents and caregivers hopefully can take on. So instead of like, here are all of the answers and here's exactly what to do, we can get back to also giving that support and, you know, ownership in the hands of families, because I think that's gone off the rails a little bit as well. And again, all this is well-meaning. I think everybody just has been feeling helpless. And then you lean into the things that are most extreme because they seem most certain. Because if, you know, if you're talking to anybody who's thinking about the science, you're never going to get like really certain answers, because that's ridiculous. We're talking about human beings here and everybody's different and all of that stuff. So, but this feels like a doable, teachable concept. And we can work on this in the absence of so much of the support systems that we're worried about not being in place in terms of mental health, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that there are things from research that do have pretty clear implications, and autonomy support is one of them. Promoting executive function skills is another one where there is research on how we can do it. And that shows how we can take the lessons from research and use them in our everyday lives. And that was the purpose of writing The Breakthrough Years. There's just so much out there that we can use, and it will make our lives as parents, as grandparents, as teachers, as anyone who has a teenager, an adolescent, or even a young child, from mind in the making.
Totally. It holds true for younger kids too. You know, it's also true that a lot of the work that we think other people, somebody who's a professional in the field or someone, might be able to do with our children to work, build these skills, the answer is not actually in that. It's at home, and we could do it. So it doesn't need to be protected content.
No. And that, you know, so I sometimes joke that I work hard so that other people don't have to. Okay. You know, I go read all of those journal articles. I go interview and film those researchers. I do my own research. just because I think that there is so much to share from the science in ways that help us be the parents we want to be.
And that just is a lot more empowering of a message than the world is on fire and this is all, you know, so dangerous. Okay, so speaking of...
World is on fire. Dennis.
Yes, the world being on fire. Yeah. No, I was just going to say, and speaking of the world being on fire, I want to get into how, and I think this actually, this to me is very aligned with the conversation about social media, because I have been so confused. Like, yes, policymakers need to do things. Yes, tech companies need to do things. But why is there this, like, why aren't we reminding everybody there's so much that we can do? We can use autonomy, supportive parenting, and executive function skill building to make it so that including things like social media do not have the kind of impact that is scaring the daylights out of people. And that is all in our hands, which I think is like really relaxing feeling.
So agree. I mean, thank you for calling out the house on fire people. I know that it gets you on talk shows. I know that it sells books. I know that it gets you in magazines. I know that it gives you a lot of attention, but it hurts the kids. Honest to God, it hurts the kids. And if we're trying to help kids, calling them, you know, the COVID generation or hopeless other words, it's just, they so bristle against that. They were like, we're not all alike. And it, you know, the internet is not going to be the end of me. You know, I have other things going on in my life. Stop. You all think we're the same. You all think we're a disaster. Stop.
No, it really is important because unfortunately, it doesn't make for as good of an interview and it doesn't make for as good of a book title and doesn't make for as good of a social media post. But it's critical for all of us to know that that's like the reality is so much more in our hands and so much less terrifying. And I understand, but I mean, I always think like it's a red flag when the number of times somebody sends me like a book or a podcast interview where somebody said something so extreme and they're like, make sure to get this in every parent's hands. I'm like, no, that is to me that your spidey sense should go up and you should recognize with your executive function skills, like, I get it. We have to say something really like igniting to get anybody's attention, but let's now have a real conversation.
I love your saying it's in our hands. I think that that's the message because actually that's what we want, you know, and if people like you, hopefully people like me, keep saying that, we can maybe stem this tide because I sure know that kids don't like it. I sure know that it's not good for kids. I sure know that we're making our problems worse by this house on fire. Yes, there are some kids who have a real hard time transitioning off of social media. That's absolutely true. It's harder for some kids than other kids. And that you know, so there are some kids for whom it's even a worse problem than for other kids. But there would be something else in that child's life that would be hard for them to transition off of if it weren't social media.
And I think even then, we have more power than we remember, which is we can notice that and make sure that we put those guardrails up and tighten those mixing metaphors if I keep going. But And I have so much empathy for the fact that part of the problem is also probably like, okay, but if I'm a parent who's noticing my child is being harmed by this, but nobody else in their cohort is getting those guardrails, then it puts more pressure on that parent. And I feel like that is terrible. And I so empathize with that. And also, that's the reality today. And so we have to remind ourselves, like, your relationship can withstand those guardrails, your connection can withstand those guardrails, and your child will be better for it because they need that protection. So, but that I do, that might be part of it. The conversation, like people feel like, well, that's not fair to parents because they're alone.
Yeah, I think that parents taking action, the parents whose kids have been harmed by social media taking action is a good thing. We need parents. We need kids to take action. I actually think that a lot of this movement should include kids. But I love your notion of repair, because I think that that's what we're talking about, that when things go off the rails, so to speak, I'll use your metaphor, that it's getting them back, it's repairing them, that is really the key to health. It is the key to well-being. We have to change the way we think about mistakes or problems or difficult situations to know that repair comes from taking on a challenge and figuring out a way to make it better. So that's another societal bugaboo that we need to take on.
When you called this book The Breakthrough Years, and I remember iterations of other titles and The Breakthrough Study, tell me what you're trying to get. I mean, it's so clear what you're trying to get across, and you landed in a beautiful place, but I wanted your overall breakthrough definition.
It was on May 5th, 2017. I happen to know that, when I interviewed a researcher named Jennifer Silvers at UCLA, and she does research on self-control and taking a near and far perspective, as well as other things. And she said to me, "These are make or break years." That's what she said. And I went, "Yes, yes, 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 uh-huh. yes." These, not in the, it's, you know, I believe strongly, and I know for sure that this is true, not in the sense of, we used to think that things in early childhood were set for life, like the first 5 years. I mean, a lot of advocates sold early childhood as like your brain is 95% of its growth, and then it's like over when they're whatever. It's not true, and it's not true about adolescence. So these aren't make or break years. I didn't want that particular phrase, but the point that Jen was making and is making is that these years are as important as the early years in terms of the plasticity of the brain. These are the years where we're setting into place who we are and whom we become. And so we have such an opportunity during this period to make a difference in our own lives when we're teenagers and in the lives of kids if we have teenagers somewhere or other in our orbit. And that was the purpose. I also think that I called it the breakthrough years for a second reason, which is that when I interviewed researchers, most of them had started doing studies on the perils of adolescence, particularly risky behavior. And then this is Evelina Crony from the Netherlands, who is the example I'll use. She was doing a longitudinal study. She had 299 kids, following them over many, many years. And she said, all of the kids have this, we talked about it before, this heightened sensitivity to they react emotionally, you know, they're sensation seekers. They like fun. They like thrilling and exciting experiences. All kids have that. It's just, again, that's developmentally necessary to helping us know when we're safe or not. That is a biological advantage that we have that. It's like we're emotional detectors to figure out what environments are okay and what aren't. But not all kids do stupid things with them, you know. And yet I'd been reading book after book and reading headline after headline about how adolescents just do these dumb, stupid, horrible, risky, terrible things. And not many do. I mean, really, you know, I ask parents about making risky decisions. It's around 12%, you know, so, you know, 9 out of 10 don't. And those who do we have a chance to turn those into positive risks, because that's how we learn. We learn by being explorative. We learn by a trial and error, particularly during these adolescent years. So even if you are more prone to sensation seeking than other kids, we can turn that around by giving them opportunities to, you know, do climbing, you know, to be in a play, to go help kids who otherwise wouldn't get helped. I mean, there are 100,000 ways that we can help our kids have positive risks in their lives. Anyway, Evelina, what Evelina said to me that I just love so much was, I said to myself, maybe this serves a different purpose. Maybe this isn't, you know, this risky behavior. She'd been doing lots of research on negative risks. And she said, I've been looking at it the wrong way. It's really something that is adaptive during these years. So she was having a breakthrough. And so many of the researchers had breakthroughs of moving away from their negative framing of adolescence to seeing what is going on inherently, developmentally, that the breakthroughs weren't just the kids, you know, and this incredible period of plasticity where we have so many opportunities. The research community did an about face and had its own breakthroughs in seeing adolescents differently.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.